Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Overnight America continues, and this is a phone call that I'm excited to air from Georgia. George is calling us. Thank you for calling in to Overnight America, George.
Good evening.
And I am excited to hear your story because I can see what you told our call screener, that you have a connection to one of the Apollo missions.
Well, the night of the landing, we were at summer camp, and as I remember it, they scheduled the landing for a full moon, and so there was a full moon out, and of course we were out in the woods at summer camp, and we were all huddled around a AM radio, listening to the landing. And we couldn't wait to get home so we could watch it on television.
I bet to see it for yourself.
And to see it. But it was really cool because I can remember looking out, looking into the tent. We're all huddled around the radio. And I'm looking up at the moon, you know, and you can cover it with your thumb.
But, knowing that it's up there. And they're there doing that right then and there.
Yeah, I met Rusty Swaggart. Now, he was a part of Apollo 9.
Yeah, tell me about that. How did you know?
Well, he got involved in Transcendental Meditation and TM, and we were involved in it back in 1968 and 69, my dad and my family. In fact, they were written up in Time magazine, and he came to a meeting in Atlanta. He's still around, and he's alive and doing well. I think he was born in about 1935.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But he was big in Transcendental Meditation. But one story I do want to tell you is when my sister went to George Washington University, and we were traveling back and forth to Washington, D.C., they just built the Aeronautics Space Museum up there in the late, early 60s. And one Tuesday afternoon, my mother and I were in there, and they had the Spirit of St. Louis, and normally it's suspended from the ceiling, and they had it down on the ground, and they were cleaning it.
Oh, cool.
And I was we were the only two civilians looking at the plane, and one of the guys looked over at me, and he said, "Do you want to sit in it?"
Oh, no way.
And I went, "Yeah." And so he opened up the door, and I got to sit in Lucky Lindy's seat.
That's amazing, isn't it?
In the Spirit of St. Louis. So that's my claim to fame there.
Did you notice anything different inside when you were
sitting there? Well, it has no windshield. It only has two side windows. And the main thing I noticed about it was all the pipes that were running across and valves for the fuel. And I never will forget that the seat was made out of wicker.
Oh, man. Was it comfortable?
Rattan. Well, I mean, it was made to be lightweight.
Yeah.
So it's like sitting in your grandmother's furniture on the back porch.
That's what it felt like. You could fall through at any moment.
Right, but I got to sit in the airplane and look around, and we got to walk around it and everything. The guys were nice enough.
Wow.
But they just brought in the Gemini capsule, the Mercury 7 stuff.
Yeah, what an experience that no one else ever will be able to experience. That's something else, George.
Yeah, it was really great.
Hey, thank you for sharing that. I'm glad you called in.
I'm glad you all enjoyed it. We'll talk later. Bye-bye.
Bye. All the way down in Georgia, get a phone call, which is just really, really cool. Look at Jim calling in from St. Louis. Hey, Jim, what's going on?
Ryan, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The space mission that I saw, I mean, I didn't like eyewitness it, but at the time, all it was, I think everybody had, we just had a black and white portable TV set. it was in the front room on a table, and I just sat in front of it and watched it. And it, I think it was like Chet Huntley, I want to say. It was one of those, you know, old-time anchormen. And the whole time, he just talked about it. I don't remember what he was saying. But the whole time, all it was the noise of the rockets and then just this little white dot in the middle of the TV screen. And I guess my mom must have told me to watch it, but that's all I remember it ever being. But I think that's the one where they landed on the moon and they had all the film of it and stuff like that. It was like, this is the very first one, as far as I know.
Wow.
Back in like 1966, 64, 5, 6, something like that.
Oh, you're talking about some of the earlier missions. Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I was like 3-4 years old. I didn't know what I mean, I knew what I was looking at, but it was just a little white dot in the middle of the black and white TV screen the whole time. That's all it was.
You still remember that? Of course you would. Yeah.
I do. Yes, I do. I remember the television vividly.
I had to look up Chet Huntley. I wasn't familiar with him. American newscaster, mostly with NBC.
This was still when, I mean, in order to, you actually would tune in the TV signal. It wasn't like the dials weren't preset. You had to like turn this. It's like it was like a radio where you would actually like turn the dial.
We had TVs like that, you know, the old black and white TVs, and it would make a big clicking sound every time you'd go to the next channel. And
no, it didn't. No, this didn't have that.
Dials on there?
It was like a radio where you could go, you know, I don't know how to explain it to you, but there wasn't any presets on it. You would actually just tune the dial in order to
get
it tuned in.
I've seen some of those on the portable TVs, the really small ones that are meant for travel.
That's what we had,
something like that. Oh, how about that? All right, Jim, thank you for that call.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
That's interesting. Chet Huntley. That guy looks like a newscaster, too. He's got that newscaster face to him. He's got those eyes, those late-night eyes on him. You know, in the first hour of the show, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to it. If you did, God bless you, because that's a long time listening to this program. I wish everyone would listen to this program for 4 hours a night. That would be awesome. But I understand the nature of how it goes. You know, you're working or you're busy or you got to go do this or got to go do with the kids or whatever it is. So we podcast the show. And if you don't know what a podcast is, it's just so you can listen back to it on a computer or a smartphone whenever you want to. And there's a link at kmox.com/ONA. ONA standing for Overnight America. And we already have the first hour up. If you wanted to listen to our conversation, we welcomed two Border Patrol agents from the Tucson area on the Tucson Sector Border Patrol. And I wanted to get their firsthand impressions of what it's like to work on the southern border when we're all debating about what should happen with immigration. How about we talk to the people that are actually working it day in and day out? What are they seeing? I want to get their experiences, and I'm going to replay part of that interview coming up next. If you didn't hear it originally, I think you're going to enjoy it, and I think you're going to learn a lot. It's Overnight America, KMOX. Earlier, to start the show, we welcomed two Border Patrol agents. And I wanted to replay part of that for you if you missed it. You can actually listen to the full interview by going to kmox.com. But I had a lot of questions for them. I also had more questions than I did time. They stayed a full hour, and there's still a lot left to ask them. And they did mention they would come back on the show. So maybe we can get them on sometime in the future. But if you ever had a question for a Border Patrol agent, man, we're going to have to do this again. I thought it was great. But what really happens down on the southern border? Let's replay part of this now. Anything you've ever wanted to ask a Border Patrol agent, this is your opportunity. Returning with us is Agent Jacob Stuckenberg, Public Affairs Office with the Tucson Sector Border Patrol, and also Agent Joe Curran, the medical technician out of Arizona. Thank you, guys. I have so many questions for you, and there's some people that are calling now with questions for you, too. I think what's important is to talk about the process, because people may see some of the pictures online, sensationalized or not, but I want to know what happens from the point of rescue or capture to the detention to the release. What's the process that someone trying to enter this country without going through a port of entry, what happens to them?
A very good question, and it's something that a lot of people don't know. So when we're in the field and we make an apprehension of several individuals or one, at that moment in time, we're going to take that individual and bring them to our truck. We're going to get some basic information, name, date of birth, things like that, and then they're going to be transported to our holding facility, the nearest station. At the station, we're going to roll their fingerprints. We call their 10 prints, and that's going to be able to give us run a criminal check on them to see if they have any wants, warrants, or if they have any immigration history in the United States or anything like that. When that information comes back, depending on what happens there, if somebody comes back, obviously, with a warrant, with an extraditable warrant, we're going to see if that warrant's still active, what have you. But let's talk about what typically happens. So let's say they come across and they say, yes, we're here illegally, what have you. We bring them to our holding facility. We run their fingerprints. They have no criminal history. At this moment in time, there's several different avenues of which could be their next step in the process. So if they claim a protected status, so if they claim asylum or something like that, we check an extra box on the computer program. I add one more piece of paper into their file, and all that information gets compiled and goes with them to the next step in the process, which is out of Border Patrol hands. So one thing to understand, we are not judge or jury or anything like that. Essentially, all we do is bring people into our holding facility. We gather information, criminal record, immigration record, put it in a file, and gather any other additional information, put it in that file, and that file goes with that person to the next step in the process.
How often do you get no record whatsoever?
Our recidivism rates are lower than what they used to be. In the year 2000, for instance, we apprehended over 616,000 people just in the Tucson sector alone.
Wow.
But the recidivism rate was very high back then because that's when we were catching mostly adult males from Mexico, and being able to repatriate them back to Mexico was very simple. If they didn't have a criminal record, we can bring them right back down to the port of entry and repatriate them back into Mexico. But now we're seeing more people from Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, places like that. And a lot of them are first timers, if you will. They don't have a immigration record or anything like that. So the recidivism rate right now is lower than it used to be. But the demographics of who's coming across is a little bit different.
Yeah. And Agent Joe Curran, I wanted to ask you about the rescues, because sometimes, and you mentioned this before we went to break, that there are opportunities, and you see that it's not just you're apprehending people that you catch. A lot of times you're rescuing people that are in pretty terrible conditions. So can you talk a little bit about what you do on the rescue side?
Sure. And here locally in Tucson sector, we have 209 agents who are cross-certified state and nationally as emergency medical technicians. So they get the same credentials, same certifications as everybody who you'd find on the back of an ambulance. They're able to provide that care to people who are in our custody. So far this year, year to date, we're at over 400 rescues just here in Tucson sector. And we're almost at 4,000 Border Patrol wide. That's a lot of rescues, and that's a lot of resources to tie up.
Yeah, give me an example of what a rescue means.
So a rescue could mean probably the most typical one is actually people calling 911. What's pretty common is the smuggler will leave somebody behind who can't keep up with the group. That person ends up lost, disorientated, without food or water, and they find a place where they can call 911. And through a very sophisticated system we have, we're able to narrow down the GPS coordinates, usually, to that person within a reasonable distance and begin search and rescue efforts off that given location.
Oh, interesting. A smuggler with a heart of gold. I'm surprised that they take through that effort. Does that happen a lot, smugglers reporting people, and they just want to leave it off their conscience?
Oh, no, I'm not talking about the smuggler calling 911. I'm talking about the person being left behind.
Oh, so they're the ones. Okay, so the smugglers aren't doing any of that. I see. Okay.
No, smugglers are leaving them high and dry and out in these very remote locations, pretty much left for dead.
Yeah, that's terrible.
So when they call 911, we're typically the only people in the area with the resources to get to them.
I see. Let's take a couple of more calls from our listeners, and this one's in Crystal City, Missouri. Scott, hi.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Ryan. Mr. Ryan, I'd like to thank you very much for bringing this topic up, and thank you very much, both of you, for your service. I was in the Navy in San Diego. I was 19 years old and dated a woman for a while, and we ended up getting married. I was 19 years old. and she was from Mexicali, Mexico. And we used to go down to Mexicali, Mexico and visit her family and stuff. And being down there after the second or third time, I used to think to myself, my goodness, I would do anything I could to get across that wall if I lived here. Now, there are a lot of people. She went through the process before she came here. She had a work visa, and she would come up here and get bused back. And then she went through the process of becoming a U.S. citizen. And when we were married, we'd go down there, but she knew a lot of people that came across the border for nefarious reasons. I mean, by coyotes and stuff that would guide them across and take every bit of money they had. And then they would have a number, and they would call to go to a safe house. And people would do that, and if you said, even if you walked into an apartment in San Ysidro or in San Diego and said, La Migra! Really loud, like it's a joke. People would scatter.
Hmm.
And the thing is that these people go through so many hardships to get here, and it's not so much the fact that they're just illegal citizens crossing the border. It is the predators that work on these people.
Yeah.
And
well,
the
Scott,
people that guide them and the people that are in America, too, that are citizens. There are American citizens that are also a part of this, and that's where the sex trafficking and things like that go on.
Yeah, Scott, what's your question for Jacob and Joe?
Hey, my question is this. Is like, do you think more of it should be focused on the government of these South American countries, or should we just go ahead and build that wall and block people from coming in here? Should we spend more money on helping these governments in certain situations? I know they're very corrupt in certain in certain South American countries.
Yeah.
Or in Central American countries also.
Okay.
But
all right, Scott, I want to make sure they have enough time to answer that question. Hey, thank you very much. And I think a lot of people do look at the effectiveness of the wall, and maybe he was looking at that side of it too. Do you have any comment, Jacob or Joe, what Scott just asked?
Absolutely, and thank you for that question. As far as working with the other governments, that's a question that's a little bit higher than my pay grade, if you will. That needs to be aimed more at Washington, D.C. But as far as the wall or the fence or whatever terminology you wish to use, let's absolutely talk about that. In Tucson sector, we're responsible for 262 miles of border. Of that 262 miles, only 71 have any type of bollard fencing or an infrastructure in that regard. So we have about approximately 140 miles of vehicle barriers outside of the bollard fencing. And then we have about 50 miles of nothing or just a little three strands of barbed wire in the very remote areas. Now, the bollard fencing is a major tool for us. It helps us. It's not the end-all, be-all solution to the issue, and every agent will tell you that, because if you build a 50-foot wall, they're going to bring a 51-foot ladder. We know that. But it's a tool that helps us do our job. It increases our situational awareness. And how it does that is because, number one, it's a deterrent. Number two, if people are so intent on going across this wall, they have to come up high and go over it. And that's where our detection technology comes into play. We have camera systems located along the border on large towers that are monitoring that fence and monitoring that border. So if we can see that incursion as it's happening, we have a very high percentage rate of either making an apprehension or deterring those individuals back to Mexico. Now, so the infrastructure and our technology work hand in hand, but you still need those boots on the ground to enforce those immigration laws, both downtown and also out in the remote mountainous areas. So it's kind of a three-pronged approach that the Border Patrol uses to make an effective system. And we have proven that to be a very effective system, because we've seen that in areas where we've implemented those three things, manpower, infrastructure, and technology. We've seen crossings go down. And this is a system that we've been asking for decades, for many years, decades, administrations, however you wish to measure time. We've been asking for that specific thing for a long time.
All right. So that's part of the interview we had from earlier. And man, I might play another segment because I really enjoyed our conversation, which we're going to do coming up next. And if you want to hear more about what really goes on in the border, don't go anywhere. It's Overnight America, KMOX. I thought we had a great conversation earlier with two Border Patrol agents from Tucson, Arizona area. And we're going to continue that replay of just a couple of parts of it, and I have one last part I want to play when it comes to child separation. You can actually listen to the full interview now by going to KMOX.com/ONA. And I want to thank everyone that has added an extra 5-star review to our podcast. Man, that means an awful lot. For people that don't understand the way discovery works online, so we post the podcast, the audio version of our show, where it's a way you can listen back to it anytime, anywhere, whenever you decide to click that button to press play. It's going to be right there. But one of the ways people find the podcast is by you leaving a 5-star review. And the way that works is just like anything else where you leave a review. You find what you want to review. Just search Overnight America in your podcast app. Your smartphone comes with one, or you can do it online. KMOX.com/ONA is a link to it. And when you leave that 5-star review, say a couple of nice words about us all. We love listening to the show. You should too. And for whatever reason, that little bit of extra effort that takes all but 60 seconds to do, that little bit of extra effort helps other people find the show, because in the background, these tech companies look at that and say, oh, so-and-so likes it. So that means other people might like it. Maybe I'll throw this guy a bone. And I mean, it goes a long way. It doesn't literally, it just takes a couple seconds for you to do it. If you've ever opened a podcast app, it would mean a lot to me for you to go online now and make sure to give a nice review of the show, a 5-star review. It would go an awful long way. All right, let's go back to this, and I'm going to replay this again. And from our first hour of the show, our guests were two Border Patrol agents letting us know what goes on the southern border. I want to thank again Agent Jacob Stuckenberg and Agent Joe Curran, the Tucson Sector Border Patrol, joining us this hour to answer your questions of what goes on at the border. And one of the biggest questions that I always wonder about is what happens when there's a scenario involving a minor. Sometimes they're coming in with people that were unable to identify as a family member. Sometimes they're coming in unaccompanied. So can you tell me what happens in your sector when a minor is involved?
Sure. I'd be happy to explain that process, because I've seen it happen all too often. So when we were getting a lot of these very large groups, it was a lot of family units, which encompassed a lot of minors. Usually minors made up at least 50% of the group. And amongst that would be unaccompanied minors. Now, how their path in the immigration system differs definitely from the adult population is unaccompanied minors, once they leave Border Patrol custody, are either turned over to Health and Human Services or to the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Hmm. Now, due to court litigation, a minor cannot be held in custody for more than 21 days, and that same thing is applied to a family unit. Mm-hmm. So it's a family unit. After 21 days, they're either released into the general population or sent to the Office of Refugee Resettlement. The unaccompanied minors, same thing. They can't exceed 21 days in custody, and that's total custody between Border Patrol and any of our immigration partners, turned over to Health and Human Services. Mm. So I don't know if you've been tracking the Congress giving us more money for the border, but that was focused on Health and Human Services to give these unaccompanied juveniles more bed space. Mm. Because the more bed space Health and Human Services have, the less bottlenecked our system becomes. And it's a less amount of time that these unaccompanied juveniles are in Border Patrol custody.
Do you find that 21 days is enough time to get that whole process through?
For a family unit, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. A lot of those family units are claiming asylum, and those cases are backlogged over a million cases now.
Oh, yeah.
So there's no way that process can happen that quickly.
Yeah. Besides people, what kind of things have you seen smuggled into the United States?
We see a lot of narcotics.
A lot.
A lot? What's a lot?
Yeah. right now, we've seen a very interesting dynamic. Our numbers for marijuana have gone down significantly. In the year 2009, we set a record when we seized over 1.2 million pounds of marijuana. And last year, we seized 134,000 pounds. So
wow.
It's almost not even a factor. However, our hard narcotics have spiked. In Tucson sector, we see a lot of methamphetamine. That's our number one. I know we also see a lot of fentanyl. In fact, about a month and a half ago, we actually had an ultralight aircraft fly from Mexico over Nogales, over our heads, and actually almost flew all the way to Tucson. It flew about, I'd say about 75, 80 kilometers, which I guess would roughly be about, 60 miles. It's quick math there. And it was actually loaded with methamphetamine and fentanyl.
Oh, wow. How do you stop something like that? What happened?
So that's a very difficult situation. In that situation, we were able to track it through our cameras. So all that detection technology that we have out there, mm-hmm. it was able to spot this as it came across. And we also worked in conjunction with our partners with Air and Marine Operations. They fly aircraft in support of us as well as other agencies. And we were able to track that. And as far as why this particular pilot landed, we're not real sure. But when that individual landed, we were able to be there within minutes and seize not only the drugs, but also that aircraft, which obviously puts a good dent in that smuggling operation.
Something I've always wondered, too, and you hear the stories that the people that are crossing the border have been coached by the coyotes on what to say once they get here. Do you find that there's a lot of commonality in the language that they're using? Is that actually a thing?
Yeah, we see a lot of individuals that do have a similar story. As far as every individual, I'm not going to speculate because, when we ask them questions, we ask them, is this your sworn testimony? And they say yes. And then, again, all we do is gather that information. So we'll ask them about their journey. We're going to ask them if anything happened. Did they get robbed? Did they get assaulted? Things like that. If an individual was assaulted, we'll call the sheriff's office in to take that police report and things like that. But we take all that information and we put it in that file that I was talking about earlier, and it goes to the next step. So if somebody claims asylum, again, we're not judge, we're not jury. We take that information that they give us, we put it in the report, and it goes with them to their asylum hearing.
Right. Yeah, Agent Jacob Stuckenberg and also Agent Joe Curran, if people actually had questions, and I know you guys have been active on social media and on the internet, and people are always wondering, and maybe they didn't get an opportunity to get through tonight, how can they reach out and ask questions if they had them?
That's a great question. So our public affairs office is always available. And that's the same thing for all the other nine Southwest border sectors. You can look us up on cbp.gov. But if you really want to see what's going on down on the border, you can look at our Twitter page and our Instagram page. I'll let Agent Curran tell you a little bit more about those.
Yeah.
So our Twitter page is going to be at CBP Arizona. And I mostly control that page. It's mostly information here, what's going on in the Tucson area. And then our Instagram is our chief's Instagram account. It's Roy_D_Villarreal.
Gotcha.
That's where you can check out all that's going on that starts here in the border and unfortunately ultimately resolves itself quite a bit in communities in the interior of the United States.
Wow. Getting a snapshot at the Tucson Sector Border Patrol and Agent Jacob Stuckenberg and also Agent Joe Curran. You spent the last hour with us here on Overnight America. I want to thank you for answering our questions, giving us a little bit of an idea of what goes down there on a daily basis. I really do appreciate it. I'm so glad you guys came on tonight.
Well, thank you for having us. We appreciate the opportunity to talk to folks back there in the Midwest.
Oh, anytime. We're going to have them back on at some point. I've already emailed them, and they said they'd love to come back. So when a little time passes and more things are happening at the border, we'll be able to do this again. So hopefully you enjoyed that. And to listen to the full interview, it was the first hour of the show, you can go to KMOX.com/ONA. Just very easy for you to check it out there. One last segment left on Overnight America, KMOX. Overnight America, one last time before we say goodnight and I get to tuck you in. A couple of things transportation-wise. I got three stories for you. And one's another type of 50th anniversary. Not the walking on the moon. You want to talk about a distraction away from a huge scandal. Another anniversary from 1969, 50 years ago. Here's CBS News.
Chappaquiddick. It's an island off of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. But for generations of Americans, it's best known as the place where Senator Edward Kennedy drove his car off a bridge, July 18, 1969, 50 years ago. A young woman passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne, was killed. Kennedy said he tried to rescue Kopechne, but failed to contact police for 10 hours.
This morning, I entered a plea of guilty to the charge of leaving the scene of an accident.
He received a suspended sentence of 2 months in jail.
Yeah.
Says the foreman of the grand jury that investigated, every time there's an anniversary, it's like it happened yesterday.
Wow.
Bud Mishkin, CBS News.
Yeah, man, he really skirted responsibility on that one. Does anyone believe that he did anything and did everything in his power to try to help her? 10 hours later, reports it. You got to be kidding me. So that's Ted Kennedy, and for some reason still looked at as a hero after all of that. But that happened just a few days before the moon landing. And man, all of that just for whatever reason gets swept under the rug when you have one of the most significant stories in all of mankind, which is landing on the moon with Neil Armstrong. It's kind of hard to draw headlines after that when everyone's keeping their eye up in the sky. Here's a transportation story. I didn't realize this, but forget Uber, forget Lyft. Maybe it's better for you to go out there and get a license to drive a school bus because, you know, they need it. There's a shortage and they're paying. I saw the story on Fox, too. I didn't realize there's such a shortage of bus drivers right now.
Well, Vic, according to the National Association of Public Transportation, there is a bus driver shortage across the country. And here at the Fox City School District, they say there are a number of reasons. One, low employment rates, and two, competing with other districts.
So Fox C6 School District, that's in Arnold, and then Kelly Hoskins reporting this out of Fox, too.
And they said they wanted to try a new approach, and that's why they say they are going to train teachers who would like to fill out for those bus driver shortages. The administration agreed to invite teachers to become licensed and trained. The district has close to 12.
How would you like to be a teacher right now? And you think to yourself, okay, there's all the pressures of the world. The funding's not there. The salary's not there. Okay, great. Now I'm going to have to learn how to drive a bus in order to make ends meet. So then they're going to ask me to drive bus after the long day already. And then, oh, you know, some days you're going to have to pick them up too. So you got that going for you. Oh my goodness. This is the things we ask teachers to do. I don't know how many of them would be raising their hands saying, oh yeah, I don't have enough to do right now. Please give me another responsibility.
12,000 students and transport close to 9,000 every day. And has about 108 bus drivers. They are still about a dozen short.
Wow, 108 bus drivers? I didn't realize there's that many bus drivers in a district. That's a lot of bus drivers. Wow.
And school starts next month. The district has tried everything to recruit new drivers, increase pay, starting wage from $4.97 to $15.50.
Economic.
Wait, what's the price? What's the, how much are you paying a bus driver? I didn't quite catch that because, you know, I even went to the website. Because there's a link on the Fox, too. And it didn't actually say how much a bus driver makes. And it didn't. And when you go to the website, if you go over to the Fox C6 School District website, because they give a link, and at the end of the article, they mention, oh, yeah, just go over there, and they'll have all the details. There was no mention of it on their website. How desperate can they be? And they still need to find, what, a dozen or so bus drivers? But they don't have it listed on their website that they're looking for this as a opportunity? That's kind of weird. Here, let me replay this one part.
There are still about a dozen short, and school starts next month. The district has tried everything to recruit new drivers, increase pay, starting wage from $4.97 to $5.15.50.
$5.15.50. $5.15.50. What do they mean by that? Am I not understanding the way that they're laying that out? $5.15.50. What does that mean? I still don't understand. That's a really weird way to put it. It's not like an hourly wage or anything like that. But either way, Fox 2's got this up there. If you want to be a bus driver, this is a good opportunity for you. Here's one other transportation thing for you. And you can find this one at KMOX.com. There was a celebrity death that happened for, they use this pretty liberally, a YouTube star. And from what I understand, her name is Emily Hartridge. And she's not someone that was necessarily super popular. And on the grand scale of things, I don't think she would be considered a YouTube star, but she did have a pretty large following. I think she was over in the UK, 26 years old. And she ended up finding herself in a fatal accident on an electric scooter on a busy streets of London. Real sad, really, really sad. Or maybe she wasn't 26. I think she was younger than that. But there was another instance, a 26-year-old in Nashville. And a death prompted the mayor to try to start the talks to ban e-scooters altogether because of the people that have been injuring themselves. And so KMOX, the story you can find online, and there's a couple of numbers. It says that according to a report published in April by Bird, which is one of the three companies that offer this thing, so there's the Lime scooters, the Bird scooters, and there's a third one out there too. It's slipping my mind what they're called. Spin? I don't know. It's not Spin. There was a different one, wasn't there? Wasn't there a different one that was... is there another company out there that offers something else then? What am I thinking of then? But apparently it says Bird scooters report one accident every 27,000 miles ridden, which equals to about 0.01% of trips, which is actually very, very low. But they do say that the numbers collected are those reported, not necessarily those that actually happen on the street. It makes you wonder how many of these accidents are actually happening there. Scooter providers in St. Louis, Bird and Lime, said they're committed to working with government officials because I think they're deathly afraid that they're going to turn up into a big pile of, you know, useless pieces of equipment like they saw with those bicycles that happened there. And because of those bicycles, and they ended up in a pile, they know that people will turn away from these things pretty quickly and they'll become obsolete. But I see these things everywhere. You can look out the window, you see them dumped all over the place. Public radio here in St. Louis said that emergency room workers are seeing as many as 11 scooter-related injuries per week. 11 per week. I wonder what they're doing, and it surprises me. It's just absolutely amazing to me that there's more people that are not hurt on these things, mostly because the way that they ride these things are pretty daring. And last night, was it last night? So I was leaving the building here, and you see the people riding these motor scooters. I don't know what they're doing at night with them, if they're just joyriding or they got nothing better to do. I don't think they're actually going anywhere. I don't think they're using that from to get to place A to B. I don't think they're going to work. But, you know, they're driving on the wrong side of the street. They're just, you know, I don't even want to say they were going in like figure eights or anything like that, but they definitely weren't using it the same way you'd see during the day. And even during the day, you see these people on the bikes. They don't follow the traffic laws. They zip around. I don't think I've ever once seen anyone on one of those motor scooters wearing a helmet. Even the pictures they use, they're not wearing helmets. So in Nashville, they're saying, you know what, maybe it's better for public safety to get rid of them altogether. It says, today I notified Nashville's 7 scooter companies of my decision to end the pilot program and ban e-scooters from our streets. That's Mayor David Brilli from Nashville. And this is one of those cities that St. Louis is always compared to. Like, don't you want to be like the Nashville? Don't you want to be one of those up-and-coming cities that's continuing to grow? It's hip. The millennials love this sort of thing. This is Nashville talking about getting rid of these. And they have seven companies. Man, that's got to be just littered all over the place with this sort of thing. And people are wondering, do we need to cut this out here in St. Louis? When you look at the numbers by themselves, you know, that's a pretty low rate of injuries being reported. We could be one death or one thing away from Mayor Lida Krusen saying the exact same thing. I think overall, they're just tired of seeing these things. It doesn't make the city look better. I mean, it's an eyesore when you see these things laying all over the place. I don't think they're maintained properly. I don't think they're tended to properly. However, they are profiting off of this. And I guess some people like it, but I don't know. It could just be a fad. Well, that about does it here for Overnight America. We'll be back again tomorrow night. Cardinals got an early one. And whenever the Cardinals start early, it probably means we'll have a full show starting at 10 o'clock. I look forward to being back with you again tomorrow. There's a few ways you can reach the show. The easiest way is on Twitter, at Ryan Recker. If you wanted to tweet at me, you can do that. And we can always communicate. If you wanted to send me links to stories, if there's something you want me to cover, I can do it that way too, at Ryan Recker. And if you miss any part of the show, you can download the podcast at KMOX.com/ONA. I know it's late at night. I know you have nothing better to do right now if you're up and you can't sleep. This is something you could do. Open up your smartphone and find that podcast app on it. If you have an iPhone, even better. Search for Overnight America. And when you find it, you'll see a picture of me on there. And there's a place for you to leave a review. Leave us a nice 5-star review. Tell iTunes or whatever podcast app you got on there that you like this show. Give us 5 stars. It goes a long way. It really does. Enjoy the rest of your night. We'll see you later.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.